This is the seventh message in our series on Revelation that started, I think, in May. We've got about four more to go, as my planning goes. And we're dealing with a large passage this morning, the largest that we've dealt with yet, chapters 12 to 14. So we're in Revelation 12. It's where we'll start, where Pastor Chris read. This falls right between Revelation 8 to 11, which is the seven trumpet judgments, and Revelation 15 and 16, which are the seven bowl judgments, the bowls of God's wrath being poured out. I've decided to take a little different approach in the message today, and that is we're going to spend about the first half just reading the text, making comments. I'm going to make some explanatory comments as we go throughout so you can know how I'm understanding every phrase and trying to make sense of it. And then when we finish the reading of the three chapters, we'll just spend a little bit of time answering some questions, essentially, that I've gotten from several of you throughout the series. A lot of them are of a pastoral nature. Why would God do this? Some of them are of an informational nature, like, do you actually believe this? And we're just going to work through some questions that I've gotten. I've actually got eight questions listed, and we're not going to get to all of them. But we're going to work through some of those and just hopefully help bring this to real life, making sense of the book as a whole. So, we're going to start with chapter 12. And chapter 12 introduces us to the cause of the conflict. So, what Revelation has been describing to this point has, in a sense, been the end of the conflict, when all of God's judgment is starting to be poured out in a climactic way. And what chapter 12 does for us is it kind of pulls the curtain back and it says, here's what's going on behind the scenes. Here's what's been going on behind the scene throughout all of history. And you'll see we're introduced right to the time when Messiah is born. So we're not in the end time at this point at the beginning of 12. We're actually getting a big overview of history. The cause of the conflict. John says, and a great sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. I think it's going to be clear that this woman represents the people of God in the Old Testament, Israel. The imagery of the sun, moon, and stars is actually taken from the dream of Joseph in Genesis 37, where he gets this vision of his family, you know, Jacob and his family bowing down to him. It's taken from that imagery. These are the children of Jacob. The fact that she's in labor and in the pains of childbirth is actually another common theme of Israel throughout the Old Testament. The birth pangs of Israel, or the birth pangs of the Messiah. Just listen to Jeremiah 4:31. I heard a cry as of a woman in labor, anguish as of one giving birth to her first child, the cry of the daughter of Zion, gasping for breath, stretching out her hands. Woe is me, for I'm fainting before my murderers. That was Jeremiah's prophecy in the days where Israel was going to be judged with captivity for all of her idolatry against the Lord. There's this whole people of God writhing in the pains of childbirth, experiencing something of the judgments of God just before Messiah came. Verse 3. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 crowns, 7 diadems. This red dragon symbolizes the violence and the ferocity of Satan. Dragon is often used to picture Egypt, Israel's arch enemy in the Old Testament. And here it is used to describe the power behind all of the enemies of God's people throughout the ages. this red dragon, this violent dragon, is given authority. And in this respect, with seven crowns on his head, he looks like a wannabe Jesus. Jesus was the one who had seven crowns on his head. And we will see that Christ is sovereign. Satan pretends to be. Verse 4, his tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. Probably referring to how Satan tried to lead a coup d'etat. Let's ruin the government of God. And he took a third of the angels with him. They joined his side. The dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. What a gross picture. This attempt at devouring the newborn Messiah was most clearly seen when Herod put out the edict to kill all the baby boys in Bethlehem under two. It was his first of many attempts to kill the Lord Jesus throughout his life. This murderous devil would rear his head again in the Pharisees when they picked up stones to throw at him when he said, "I am." Or when the people of his own hometown of Nazareth tried to run him off the cliff because they said he's a blasphemer. Verse 5. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron, Jesus Christ, fulfilling the promises of Psalm 2, the Davidic covenant. But her child was caught up to God and to His throne. And with that, you get the life of the Messiah here on earth. He's born and He's ascended. And you say, why did John skip so much of what happened in his life, like the miracles? Or why did he skip the death of Christ on the cross? Why did he skip the resurrection? It's to show that satanic opposition to Jesus throughout his life was like a blip. It's relatively short-lived. And that little fact, it's so short-lived. It's going to be of great encouragement to the church that's going to experience the same kind of wrath. And also, he does it to show that God protected Jesus with great ease. Satan wanted to devour him, and yet God took him. Verse 6. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1260 days. It's the equivalent of 42 months or 3.5 years. And this is a place where you can see why it's easy for so many people to interpret the 3.5 years as symbolic of the entire church age. I don't take that view, but this is one of those that you wrestle with. Like, he's caught up and then she goes out and there's 1260 days. And you wrestle with, is that a symbolic thing? And you go back to Daniel chapter 9. You go through the 70 weeks again and you say, what's symbolic? What's literal? You struggle with that. I think it's the literal 3.5 years, and it's basically fast forwarding in history to the very climax of Satan's rage. And God is saying here that during those 3.5 years before Christ's return in glory, this woman is protected. She goes to the wilderness where she is nourished. This is a time where He protects His people through the horrors of His judgments. And now we zoom in, starting with verse 7, on what took place around the time of Jesus' death, resurrection, and ascension. Verse 7 of chapter 12. Now war arose in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was defeated. And there was no longer any place for them in heaven. This describes the age-old conflict that you see most clearly in the book of Daniel. And this war was decisively won. That's what we're being told when it says there was a war going on and John sees the devil cast down. That war was decisively won at a point in time in history. Verse 11 says, it's the time when the Lamb shed His blood. How did the saints win the victory? They overcame Him by the blood of the Lamb. This victory was won at the cross. Verse 9 says, and the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of His Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. The victory over Satan and the victory for us as Christ's people was decisively won at the cross. And God's people experience this victory as they believe it and keep believing it. Verse 11, they have conquered Him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. It's a way of saying their consistent testimony to the gospel. They kept on believing the message. They kept on clinging to the message. Despite all of their trials, they never let go of the message. Despite how the people around them tried to belittle them and how they tried to persecute them, they kept on holding to the testimony. And they conquered by holding on to the message of the cross. They didn't love their lives even unto death, is the last statement of verse 11. They clung to the gospel more than they clung to their very life. Verse 12. The song continues. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. Christ won the victory at the cross. He ascended and He took the scroll. He is Lord of the universe, Lord of history. And all of heaven is rejoicing. But it's not yet done on earth. Craig Blomberg says, the decisive death blow to the devil was dealt by the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. That serpent has had a knife put to his throat. But like a snake with its head cut off, wriggling out of control in the death throes, the fatally wounded devil thrashes about violently on the earth, doing as much damage as possible in the comparatively short period of time left before he expires altogether. That's what's going on. He's been dealt the death blow and he's cast to the earth. His time is short, but he is flailing because his time is short. Verse 13. And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, that he lost the war, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she is to be nourished for a time, times and half a time. Read Exodus 19:6 and you realize the imagery here is just like God did in Egypt. He once again bears His people on eagle's wings, and He carries them out from the oppression of Egypt into the wilderness, where He comforts them as His people. He speaks to them and relates to them and draws near to them. Verse 15. The serpent poured water out like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with the flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured out from his mouth. It's hard to understand whether this is a specific event referred to or whether this is simply saying God protects His people. And when Satan throws trials at His people, sometimes God, as we'll see, lets him, through His agents, make war on His people. And at other times, God says, nope, I'm going to stop it right there. It's a way of saying God's in total control. Verse 17, then the dragon became furious with the woman. He went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. So the woman's offspring is the church. the phrase, those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. If you look back at chapter 1, chapter 14, in which we're going to read verse 12, chapter 19, verse 10, it clearly refers to the saints, John's brothers. This is language with which he talked to the church. So while the woman goes to the wilderness and is protected, Satan goes off to make war during these 3.5 years on the church. You can see the complexity of the interpretation. It says, and he stood on the sand of the sea. And here it appears that the devil is waiting for the beast to come out, and we'll see the beast come out of the sea in chapter 13. So let me just summarize chapter 12. It reveals the cause of the conflict. What stands behind all of the opposition to God's people before Christ, at Christ's time, and after Christ? And in the end, what is behind it all? Nothing other than the violent, murderous, powerful destroyer himself. Chapter 12 teaches that God's suffering church is experiencing all this persecution that comes from a devil who's already been defeated. And his time is short-lived. Chapter 12 is very encouraging to God's people. It's quick. It's already been won. You have to fight the battle recognizing that the victory has already been won. And some people use as an illustration of this the Battle of the Bulge. Hitler's already been destroyed, but he goes out flailing. It was a bloody battle. But he had already been deposed and he knew his time was short. That's what's going on here. It means that the persecution against God's people is short-lived. It means that they've already won. So hold on. Chapter 13. The climax of the conflict. The climax of the conflict. John says, and I saw a beast rising out of the sea. The sea is often symbolic for the raging of the nations, like in Psalm 46. He has 10 horns and 7 heads, saying he rules over the nations, with 10 diadems on his horns and blasphemous names on his heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's. Its mouth was like a lion. Now don't try to draw this. Again, this is where I say like I did last message. You've got to think of this in symbolic terms. If you're thinking that, you know, Antichrist is going to be, you know, a multi-headed monster with a single mouth, you've missed the point. Because he's using heads and horns and crowns and all of these animals, they're all drawing from the Old Testament. If you remember the book of Daniel, Daniel sees 4 beasts. And John is given a vision in which this is basically the climactic conglomeration of all the anti-God civilizations of history. They're all summed up in one. That's what's being communicated. Has great authority. John says, and to it, to this beast, the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. So this will be the dying devil's final and worst attempt on God's people. Verse 3 of chapter 13. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. I think this is communicating when it says one of his heads. You go back to the imagery in Daniel and it seems to be saying that this is representative of the Antichrist's authority over some kind of national entities. One of his heads seemed to have a mortal wound and yet it recovers. I think it's communicating that one of the entities over which Antichrist ruled was threatened. It was tried to be, you know, militarily overthrown. And it was not able to be. And it put the whole world in fear of that guy's power. Like, that guy's invincible. We better not mess with him. And so everyone now cows to him. You don't mess with that. Verse 4. And they worshiped the dragon. What else could they do? At least in their mind, in their deceived mind. For he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast and who can fight against it?" This is obviously a blasphemous worship against God. Emperor worship was common in John's day. It's not uncommon in our own. You remember the video of Albanian history, recent history that we watched just a few weeks ago, and how the emperor encouraged all the children to worship him as father. It's not uncommon in our day. Who is like the beast is directly blasphemous. Taking up language in Exodus, who is like our God? Who is like the Lord our God? And these people are giving that kind of worship to the beast. Verse 5. And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words. And it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months, same period of time. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. And also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over tribes, over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all who dwell on the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of the life of the Lamb that was slain. Notice the subtle ways in those verses, verses 5 through 8, that God's sovereignty over this blasphemous, arrogant beast is highlighted. Look, the beast was given, verse 5. And it was allowed, later in the verse. Verse 7, it was also allowed to him. This is why we say that the devil and everything he does is on God's leash. And if that wasn't expressing God's sovereignty in this horrifying time enough, we're told God won't even lose one. All the names of his people were written before the world was ever created in the book of the life, in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. God is in total control of history before it ever began. He's not going to lose one of his people. He chose them then, and they're not going to cave in to the Antichrist and his power. God is in control. And then we're instructed, verse 9, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. In other words, God's people, God's saints, God has determined the type of suffering that every one of you will endure. And if God's determined it for you, you're going to go through it. Take comfort in that. And if anyone is to be slain with the sword, he must be slain. Saying the same thing. Here is a call for the endurance and the faith of the saints. Here at Tri-County Bible Church, endure. Keep on believing. God's in control. God's ordained it all. Don't throw in the towel. The way Joseph Trafton puts it, he says, any temptation to relax your commitment to the Lamb must be avoided. God's in control. Don't swap sides. Then in verses 11 to 18, we get a second beast. The first one is often called the Antichrist. Here he's called the beast. The second one is often called the false prophet. Here he's called the beast out of the land. Verse 11. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. The horns here say it makes him look like a lamb. In other words, this beast looks tame. This beast looks like Jesus. and yet he speaks like the devil. It exercises, verse 12, all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and it makes the earth and all its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. So this false prophet deceives people into, yeah, the worship of the beast is the right thing. Remember, you can't go against him. It's not good to step out of line with the current trends. Verse 13, it performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to the earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might not even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. So this deceptive prophet in that day is working on behalf of the beast, but he doesn't exercise it in the oppressive authority of the beast. He exercises it in deception, even miracle working, saying, you got to go along with this. And everyone, even those would-be skeptics, are drawn into saying, yeah, you're right, you're right. And they're deceived. Verse 16, also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is the name of the beast or the number of its name. You say, what does that mean? Well, on the right hand or the forehead means this sign is conspicuous. Don't necessarily think that this means a physical mark on your body. Like, you know, everyone's going to see the mark in your forehead. Don't necessarily think, oh, they're talking about credit card chips in the wrist or things like this, that, oh, that's the mark. I mean, it could be. But you got to think as well, the sign on the forehead was used in chapter 7 and it's going to be used in about two verses to describe God's people. They're all marked with a sign too. What this is communicating is that the false prophet is going to deceive people into giving themselves wholeheartedly to the beast. Such allegiance to the beast is going to be critical in that day for any business transaction, and it's going to be critical to your survival. You won't be able to get food without it. This is a matter of allegiance, whose property they are. And it may be marked physically, it may not be. Verse 18 says, this calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. The number of his name, the number of a man, what are we talking about? It refers to the way in the Greek alphabet that letters were assigned numerical value. My name, Joseph, in English would be J10 plus O15 plus S19 plus E5. I'm counting the letters in the alphabet. And you total up the letters of my name, and my name comes out to, I think, 173. 73, if I calculated it rightly. So the number of my name is 73. So whose name makes 666? It's not just three digits, 666. That's how it appears here. It's actually 666. And there are dozens of suggestions that people have thrown out. It says at the first part of verse 18, this calls for wisdom. And I'm telling you right up front, I'm your pastor, and I lack wisdom. I do not know what this means. There it is. Irenaeus, two generations after the Apostle John, was commenting on what the 666 referred to and who this beast was, and he didn't know He threw out a couple suggestions, and he guessed at one of the emperors. But to fit any of the emperors, you know, throughout history, or the kings throughout history, into this, you always have to mess with their names. So, for example, to get my name up to 666, you might say, well, it could be Joseph Kirk Tierpak. Or it could be, if you totaled the numbers in Joseph Kirk Tierpak, the son of Peter Tierpak, now, oh, hey, well, let's take out the and just say Joseph Kirk Tierpak, son of, you know. And you can, like, okay, you're trying. Apparently, in John's day, people knew what it meant. Since about two generations, we haven't known. That may be the wisdom of God saying, when he says, this calls for wisdom, it's saying, don't count the letters in people's names. It's saying, watch out for the mark of the beast. Whether it's in your hand or not, do not swear allegiance to anyone other than Jesus. And 666, some people suggest, may be that which falls entirely short of Jesus. You can study that out on your own. Chapter 13 then centers on two individuals, the Antichrist and the false prophet. The first, the Antichrist, is the climax of thousands of years of persecution and political oppression of God's people. And the false prophet is the climax of thousands of years of deception against God's people. John calls the church to great discernment, the church in his day. Now let's think about this tri-county. This is not something that you say, oh, that's for that time. Because the same writer, at about the same time, is going to write his letter to the church, to a church. And he's going to say, 1 John 2:18, you've heard that Antichrist is coming. And he doesn't deny that fact. You've heard that Antichrist is coming, but I tell you, he's here. When John calls on the church to have wisdom, and when he calls on the church to endure, he's talking to people in our day who are not living in the climactic expression of this anti-God world. He's calling to people in our day, say, show discernment. You walk circumspectly, wisely, carefully, cautiously in this world, and beware of loosening your allegiance to Jesus. Chapter 14 is the end of the conflict. The end of the conflict. That was the climax of it, with these expressions of persecution and deception in their fullest form. And then we come to the end in chapter 14. Let me just say this. John said, you've heard that Antichrist is coming, but he's already here. I think based on that kind of logic, we could also say, you've heard that the false prophet is coming, but recognize that the false prophet's already here. Use wisdom. In our day, how many Christian churches preach the gospel? Roman Catholic, Anglican, Episcopal, Presbyterian, Baptist, Congregational, Independent, Bible. How many Christian churches, those who would say they worship Jesus Christ, preach the gospel? In other words, if you went in and you said, how can I, a sinner, be right with God? How can I enter the kingdom? Would they be able to tell you what the Bible says? We live in an age where the spirit of the false prophet prevails, and it is getting worse and worse within evangelicalism. The pray a prayer, walk an aisle kind of decisionalism is like the new works-oriented Roman Catholicism. You talk to someone who lives like the devil, and you say, when did you get saved? When did you become a part of God's people? That was when I was 14 and I made a decision in a night. How has it affected your life? I guess maybe for a couple weeks it did. That is not a true conversion. That is someone on whom, you know, the seed fell into thorny ground. It immediately grew up. It didn't bear fruit. And Jesus says, it's not my true people. Beware, Christians, of the false prophet. How quickly churches go away from the truth. And it's always through good-sounding words. It's always through things that seem to make Jesus more palatable, more encouraging. Beware. Beware. Chapter 14. Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion, a symbol for heaven, stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. The beast has his people, and the Lamb has his. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the roar of many waters, like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. Try to make sense of that sound. In other words, the song is terrifying in its strength. It is deafening in its volume. And as D.A. Carson interprets the sound of harps, it is a sound of foot-stomping happiness. Harps in that day would be more equivalent to like acoustic guitars or banjos in our day. Don't think, little white angels on clouds. Think, this is celebration. That's the point. And it is loud. And if you heard it, that celebration would put the fear of God in you, is what's being communicated. And they were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. We'll come back to that in just a minute. But I want to talk about this new song. I believe that the 144,000 represent the entire people of God, Old Testament and New. It's 12 times 12 times 1,000. God has not lost one of His people. And here they are, all in heaven, at the end of the conflict, singing to the Lamb. And they're singing a new song. No one else in all creation can sing this song. I think the words of a simple recent praise song that I heard on an island recording capture the idea perfectly. The song is called "A Song Holy Angels Cannot Sing." Angels never knew the joy that is mine, for the blood has never washed their sins away. Though they sing in heaven, there will come a time when they silently listen to me sing Amazing Grace. It's a song holy angels cannot sing. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound. It's a song holy angels cannot sing. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Holy is the Lord, the angels sing, all around the throne of God continually. For me to join their song will be a natural thing, but they just won't know the words to Love Lifted Me. It's a song holy angels cannot sing. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound. It's a song holy angels cannot sing. I once was lost, but now I'm found. The new song that all of God's redeemed people will be able to sing on that day is unique to them. There'll be a unique song in the heavenly chorus. Verse 4. Getting back to the description of 144,000, it is these who have not defiled themselves with women. That's a description that fits men, right? You would think, oh, these are celibate guys. But then we're told they're virgins, a term that in the Greek New Testament always refers to women. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever He goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouth no lie was found, for they're blameless. These are symbolic ways, a whole variety of symbolic ways of saying that these are saved sinners who never forsook Christ for another lover. They never, look down in verse 8, they never committed fornication with the world, that great prostitute Babylon. Instead, they faithfully followed Him through thick and thin. And just like the first fruits of the harvest were God's, so out of all the people on the earth, these people are God's. They're the first fruits. They belong to Him. And in their mouth no lie was found. They're blameless. In the words of Jude, Jesus Christ presents us before His Father, spotless, with exceeding joy. There are the people of God. If you want to make that 144,000 there, you know, Israel, you kind of struggle saying, well, they're just guys. Or no? Are they? No? And it's much easier to say, this is loaded symbolic imagery that communicates five truths all at once about who these people are. It's very difficult to fit it into, you know, that in that day there are 144,000, this or that, singing a song that no one else knows. I'm just not sure. It seems much simpler and much more transparent to take it as I have. Verse 6, then I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. And he said with a loud voice, fear God and give Him glory, because the hour of His judgment has come, and worship Him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water. This is the first angel proclaiming judgment. In other words, he's saying, this is your final chance. It's done. And it's done in verse 8. Another angel, a second, followed, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all the nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. So God finally judges this great city of man who's so anti-God and anti-Christ. And another angel, verse 9, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on its forehead, on his forehead or hand, he'll also drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength. This is undiluted into the cup of His anger. And he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. In other words, this is vindication. Verse 11, and their smoke, the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, these worshippers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. So here at Tri-County, John is saying this to his readers. Here's a call for you, saints. Those who follow the beast will be eternally tormented. So don't be tempted to throw in the towel or loosen your allegiance to Christ for a life that seems more comfortable or more socially acceptable. Don't back down. Don't cave in. Verse 13, I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them. In other words, how blessed are those who die because the weariness, the labor of this life is over. Isn't that exactly what we read regarding Christian, when faithful is killed in Vanity Fair and hopeful comes out and is saved as a result of faithful's testimony? Faithful is killed, hopeful comes out, and Christian says, oh, I wish I were faithful, because he doesn't have any battles still ahead of him. His labors, his weariness is over. And when when the voice from heaven says, "Blessed are the dead who die and their weariness is over," the Spirit says, "Amen to that." The harvest, verses 14 to 20. "Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud. And seated on the cloud was one like a son of man, with a golden crown on his head, a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, 'Put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe.' He who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, the angel who has authority over the fire, and he called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle, 'Put in your sickle. Gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, for its grapes are ripe.' So the angel swung his sickle across the earth, gathered the grape harvest of the earth, and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and the blood flowed from the winepress as high as the horse's bridle for about 190 miles. This is absolutely horrifying. God Himself is stamping out His enemies, just like young girls at harvest time would stomp around in the wine presses, pressing out the grape juice. That's what God is doing to His enemies. He's harvesting the earth. This is the end of the conflict. His people are safe in heaven, and His enemies have three angels say, "Judged, judged, judged. Take the sickle." They're gone. It is a horrifying but just end to history. So, Pastor Joe, do you believe that the church will be in the tribulation? Absolutely. Absolutely. Does that mean that the rapture will come before the tribulation? Or after the tribulation? I don't know. Revelation doesn't seem to address the question. That's a systematic conclusion. That is not in view here. God's people, God's church is there. Whether they are converted after we're raptured, or whether pre-trib rapture is wrong and we're raptured at the end, God's people are there. Revelation sees them in every chapter. They're there. You keep saying, Pastor Joe, that the church in the end will be protected. But the church looks persecuted to me. Come on, which is it? Yeah. That's the point. God's people don't experience an ounce of the outpouring of His wrath. It is not intended for them. But they do experience the making war of the wrath of Satan and his beast and his prophet. So are they protected? Absolutely. Are they persecuted? Yes. Do they experience different kinds of persecution? Are there those people who in that time don't experience any? Apparently. In chapter 11, it was like part of the temple was marked off and part of it wasn't. Here, apparently, some go out into the wilderness and are nourished for that time period. And so the devil goes off and makes war of others of them. They're both. Have you ever considered, if you want, you can flip over to Luke 21. We're almost there. Luke 21. You ever considered these words? Luke 21, starting in verse 16. Jesus is speaking in an end times context, eschatological context. He says, "You will be delivered up, even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and some of you they will put to death. You'll be hated by all for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head will perish. I just thought he said, some of you will die. And then he says, not a hair of your head will perish. It's a way of communicating exactly what we're talking about. He's saying, you may be persecuted in one sense, but they cannot destroy your security. It's like Paul saying, nothing will ever separate us from the love of God. Not anything now, not anything then. No tribulation, no distress, no danger. Nothing can separate you from the love of Christ. And you say, but Paul, you just said that all of us are like sheep. We're being slaughtered all day long. Nothing can ever separate you from His love. You're safe. Wow. Why does the Bible have such grotesque images? Because they're conveying even grosser, more horrifying realities. The reality that stands behind the pressing out of the grapes in Revelation 14 is worse than the image that conveys it. It's horrifying. Do not forget how holy God is. Do not forget how just He is. Do not forget that the Jesus who loves you, this I know, Jesus loves me, this I know. We teach our girls that. We want them to know it. We want them to know that He is loving and caring. And when we're weak, He's strong. But don't forget, that is the same Jesus that presses out these grapes. He is the same Jesus. He is the same Jesus who bore the wrath of God in our place. Don't have a namby-pamby, wimpy view of Jesus. He's just so loving. He just makes me feel good. No, He stomps people. And He does it justly and in love. None of you would ever get upset if a murderer got sentenced to prison in Painesville. None of you would ever say, oh, that judge was so unloving. We just think too little of sin when we ask questions like, how could a loving God do this? Pastor Joe, do you really believe in eternal torment in hell for those who are not Christians? Absolutely. With trembling. And Christians, we must never lose sight of the horrors of hell. Life's not merely about keeping our schedule together. And life's not merely about promotions at work. And life's not merely about the weekends. People are dying and going to hell. We need to reaffirm our allegiance to Jesus and reaffirm the sobering realities of life. The one true world that God has created includes a hell. We must not forget it. I think I need to end there. Believers, hear this message that John wrote to the seven churches of Asia Minor about the future. And take comfort that God's got it all in control. Reaffirm your grip on the gospel. Do not let it go. The war's already won. Jesus won it. Don't let go of Him. Regardless of the trials, and some of you in here are going through horrifying trials, do not give up. Don't leave God's people. Don't leave Christ's flock. Keep on believing through the pain. This is a call for endurance. It's a call to not let go. God's in control and there's going to be an end. And we are so prone as Christians to think, oh, I want it to be fixed next week. Or I just want to escape the trial. I want to put it behind me like I close the door on the office on Friday at 5 and I don't have to think about it till Monday at 8. The door on the office gets closed when you see Jesus on Mount Zion and you're singing the new song. That's the weekend you're looking forward to. And you're not going to get it till then. And some of us are going to go through worse times than others. But the weekend doesn't come till we see Jesus.